time to start, and I think the gathering hordes are not coming in anymore, so we'll get started. Today we're talking about Reformed Presbyterians in the Civil War. And this is the culmination, really, of a lot of things that the RP Church had been working on for several generations. The young Covenanter soldier ran with his comrades across the fields in hot pursuit of retreating Confederates. Through a heavy May rain, his unit, which was Company F of the 10th Missouri Volunteer Infantry, led the attack. After months of tedious efforts to capture Vicksburg, General Grant had directed part of his vast Army of the Tennessee to capture Jackson, the capital of Mississippi, and thus prevent Confederate General Joseph Johnston from reinforcing Vicksburg. So this was all part of the Vicksburg campaign. Now, within 3 miles of Jackson, this unit, the 10th Missouri, was leading the assault on Jackson's defenders facing the 24th South Carolina Regiment. In the running battle, Andrew Todd Kennedy was shot in the left foot and unable to continue. It was the front part of his foot. He lost 4 metatarsals in that wound. He was one of his regiment's 85 casualties that day. Kennedy was taken in an ambulance to a temporary hospital in the Jackson City Hall. And the same thing as the City Hall again today. Less than 24 hours later, the Confederates retook the city, and the retreating Union forces abandoned their wounded. So began his experience as a prisoner of war, which lasted for 59 days. We talk about the Marines never leave a man behind. Well, the U.S. Army, at that point anyway, left men behind. He was taken to Libby Prison in Richmond, which was a notorious prisoner of war camp. Now, the Confederates had a number of prisoner of war camps, and so did the Union, scattered all across the countries. So Kennedy was in Libby Prison until he was paroled on July 6, which was just 2 days after the Union victories at Vicksburg and Gettysburg. It was later found that the musket ball had fractured the metatarsal bones of the first, second, third, and fourth toes, and the subsequent gangrene destroyed a great deal of tissue. Covenanters who fought in the Civil War had the same variety of experiences as other soldiers, both North and South. Some came through the war physically unscathed, some with physical or psychological wounds that lasted a lifetime. Others failed to come through at all. Kennedy was fortunate in getting medical attention while the gangrene could still be controlled and in being exchanged relatively quickly. Since all prisoner exchanges occurred at Richmond, Virginia, he spent several weeks in Libby Prison. And you see the outside of it on the left and then a painting of a scene from inside showing the crowded and unsanitary conditions. Libby Prison, by the way, was called that because the building was the Libby canning factory. You've seen ads for Libby, 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 and you can buy Libby's vegetables and so on. Well, that's that company. They were in business then and they're in business again. So that was why it's called Libby Prison. Did the Covenanters believe that war was necessary to destroy slavery? Yes, as a last resort. The editor of the Reformed Presbyterian magazine seemed to express the view of the church in February 1860 in an essay titled "The Country's Dangers, Their Causes and Remedies." The country, he said, was in danger of losing its liberty, of civil war, and of punishment from God. The remedy was, he said, in the first place, to let slavery in all its odiousness be held up to be loathed and despised. In other words, show them what slavery really is all about. It is one of the things that cannot bear the light. It must not be let alone. It must be dragged to the light. In the second place, he said, let the evils of the Constitution be removed and let it exemplify the scriptural institutions of civil government. Until this is done, he said, the favor and approval of God need not be expected. In the third place, the editor says, let slavery be met and put down with its own weapons. This is the alternative if the two preceding fail. Slavery, he said, is set up and maintained by force, demands unconditional submission, and maintains itself by the sword. Cruelty is an essential part of the slave system. Then he says the slave power cannot find fault with those who counter it with the same weapons. Of course, they did find fault, but not logically, I suppose. Since RPs would not vote in political elections and therefore were often misunderstood, the members of Synod felt that some explanation needed to be made to the government and people of the country about the position of the church. They believed the war to be an iniquitous war in the, in the interest of slavery against the United States. They heartily acknowledged the, and I quote, numerous excellencies of the civil institutions of the land. Its code of laws were just in general. They professed thankfulness for the privileges and protection afforded them. Notwithstanding all this, they were constrained to maintain, as we and our fathers have heretofore done, a state of dissent from the Constitution of the United States. Inasmuch as there is in this instrument no acknowledgement of the name of God Most High and Eternal, no recognition of the supremacy of His law contained in the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments, no profession of subjection to the mediatorial authority of the Son of God, who is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. While on the other hand, the Constitution contains certain compromises in the interest of slavery and slaveholders. The Synod set out four declarations to prevent the public's misunderstanding their position. Number one, we disclaim all allegiance to the government of any foreign nation. In other words, their reluctance, any reluctance they had, and there was some, to fighting on the side of the Union was not because they favored the Confederacy. Second, they said, we consider ourselves under obligations to live peaceably with all men, to advance the good of society, and to conform to its order in everything consistent with righteousness. And that was the catch, wasn't it? In everything consistent with righteousness. In the third place, we disown all sympathy, even the least, with the traitors styling themselves the Confederate States, now in arms against these United States. And fourth, we will, as true patriots, defend this, our common country, against these and all like enemies. On two occasions during the war, representatives of the Reformed Presbyterian Church met with President Lincoln at the White House regarding public affairs. The first of these was announced in a special dispatch of the Pittsburgh Gazette of December 12, 1862. Now, this came about after the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, before it was finalized, but the preliminary one, and after the disastrous midterm elections, before the final proclamation. The Pittsburgh and New York presbyteries of our denomination sent Reverend A.M. Milligan and J.R.W. Sloan to call on the president to urge him to steadfastly adhere to his proclamation of freedom. They had an interview of over an hour and came away highly gratified with the results of the conversation. I'm quoting from their report. Mr. Lincoln assured them that he believed emancipation was the only salvation of the country and that there could be no peace until slavery was abolished, and that he meant to stand by his proclamation. The same synod, 1863, that had received this report, appointed a committee to visit the president a second time, now on the subject of the nation's duty to acknowledge God and Christ and his law, and to do this in the Constitution. The committee was Samuel O. Wiley, J.R.W. Sloan again, and William Brown, who was a ruling elder from Second Philadelphia, reported to the Synod of 1864 that they had presented the matter to the president and found the result of their mission to be hopeful and encouraging. Now, the president, we need to understand, was walking a tightrope. He was trying to ensure that the border states did not defect to the Confederacy, trying to keep Britain from recognizing the Confederacy or destroying the blockade, trying to satisfy the Northerners opposed to slavery and those whose major interest was simply in preserving the Union. Lincoln's responses to both the RP delegations were common during the war. Ministers of a variety of denominations, Methodist, Baptist, New School Presbyterians, Quakers, met with the president to urge emancipation, to advise him how to win the war, and so on. Loath as he was to offend the clergy, he often spoke encouraging words, but made no promises. On one occasion, he told a ministerial delegation, "I hope it will not be irreverent for me to say that if it is probable that God would reveal his will to others on a point so connected with my duty, it might be supposed he would reveal it directly to me." Stephen Douglas, in a kind of backhanded compliment, which has a lot of truth to it, "Mr. Lincoln has a fertile genius in devising language to conceal his thoughts." And you just about have to. We've got a president now who can't conceal his thoughts, and we can see the trouble that that causes. Covenanters in the armed forces. Covenanters went into the war in substantial numbers. No record was made at the time, so we don't have a list. In 1908, an effort was made to reconstruct a record. Some 400 names were gathered, but the list was so obviously incomplete that the project was abandoned. And if you're interested in that, you can look in the files of the Christian Nation, one of our periodicals of the time, about this list that they were trying to work on. But we do know some of the statistics. New Concord, Ohio, with a total membership of 210, sent 50 men to the war. That's a quarter of their membership. Elkhorn Congregation, later called Oakdale, sent 50 men, including their pastor, Andrew Todd, Andrew C. Todd. Of these 50 men who went from Elkhorn, 31 joined on the first day possible, and they elected their pastor, Andrew C. Todd, as captain. One of these 31 was his nephew, Andrew Todd Kennedy, the soldier we talked about at the beginning of today's class, who was wounded in Jackson, Mississippi. Now, Illinois' quota of volunteers filled so quickly that Todd's company had to cross to St. Louis in order to be mustered in. So they became Company F, or part of Company F, of the 10th Missouri Volunteer Infantry. You have to realize Missouri was a border state, and so they had both Union and Confederate units, and there was a 10th Missouri Infantry, which was Confederate. And so, you know, if you're reading an account of a battle, you've got to remember which, you know, Tennessee had the same problem, too. Some units, regiments were for the Union and some were Confederate. Many of the countless Covenanters who served in the ranks lived with death, injury, or imprisonment. A few more statistics, pretty much at random. Brownsville, Ohio had 55 members and sent 14 to the war. Brookland congregation here in the northern part of Westmoreland County sent 17. Clarinda, Iowa sent 23. New Alexandria, east of us a little way, sent 27. Bloomington, Indiana sent 21. Of the 17 men from the Brookland congregation in Westmoreland County, one of them was Thomas Banks, who was later an elder in the congregation. He served as an aide to General Phil Sheridan and was beside him on his famous ride. Some of you may have encountered the poem Sheridan's Ride. Sheridan thought his army was safe at a certain location, and he went to Winchester on business, but the Confederates attacked the army, and so they sent a messenger to Winchester, 20 miles away, to fetch the general, and he came galloping, and as Thomas Banks, his aide, rode beside him, they said stirrup to stirrup, and in this picture, over clear on the right, you see an officer following General Sheridan, and I presume that that's to represent Thomas Banks. These are not all RPs by any means, but 69 Geneva College students or alumni served, of whom only two, who were not Covenanters, were in the Confederate Army. Of the 67 who served in the Union Army, two became generals, Robert P. Kennedy and Benjamin P. Runkle. One was a surgeon, three chaplains, two majors, three captains, three lieutenants. 12 Geneva College graduates were killed in action. The commander of the Pennsylvania Reserves at the Battle of Gettysburg was not an RP at the time, but he was the son of a former Covenanter pastor. His father had gone from the RP church into the New Lights in 1833. But Samuel Wiley Crawford, named for one of the great Philadelphia Covenanter preachers, Samuel Wiley, became, first of all, a surgeon. He was stationed at Fort Sumter, and at Fort Sumter they were so short of men that he was put in charge of a battery of artillery defending the fort against the Confederate shelling. He decided, I don't know whether he enjoyed that or what, but he decided that he wanted to be in the infantry. So, and in 1862, he was promoted to Brigadier General, served in the Valley Campaign, Northern Virginia Campaign. He was wounded at the Battle of Antietam. In May 1853, he was given command of the Pennsylvania Reserves Division. And in Gettysburg, on the second day of the battle, July 2, he was in command at the Valley of Death, which was right beside Little Round Top. It's the southern end of the Union line. He was breveted to Brigadier General and then breveted to Major General. Brevet means it's a reserve rank. He had the duties of a Major General, but if he was going to retire from the Army, he would not have the pension of a Major General. In 1865, in April, he was present at Appomattox Courthouse. He was one of only two Union officers that were present at both the beginning and the end of the war. At his end of the battlefield, that is the southern end, at Little Round Top, the most crucial turning point was the heroic charge by Colonel Joshua Chamberlain in the 20th Maine Regiment. You may know the story. When they ran out of ammunition and the rebels were still coming, attacking uphill, Chamberlain ordered, "Fix bayonets, charge." And they did, and the rebels figured the Yankees were still so strong that they didn't stand a chance, so they fled as fast as they could. The Union held Little Round Top, and that was crucial to the success of that battle because that was the southern end of the Union line, and if the Confederates had managed to get beyond behind them, they could have rolled up the Union line, and most of the Union army would have been caught between two rows of Confederates. So this was a crucial point. One of the very interesting RPs in the Civil War was David B. Wilson, the son of Reverend J.M. Wilson and grandson of James Renick Wilson. He was a surgeon for the Army and saw service in the Vicksburg campaign. He got his bachelor's degree from Penn in 1860, his A.M. in 1863, his M.D. from Jefferson Medical College in 1863. Now, I figure he must have been one busy boy to get a master's degree and an M.D. at the same time. But he did. When he graduated B.A. at Penn, he got the Greek Prize for being the best Greek scholar in the university. So he was a very bright fellow. He served in the Medical Corps in the Union Army from 1863 to 1865. After the war, interestingly, he went to seminary, then took a year in law school, and then decided to become a pastor in Allegheny, PA. Received his Doctor of Divinity, which is an honorary degree, from Penn in 1890. And in 1875, he was elected to the faculty of RPTS, where he served almost until his death in 1916. He was married, yes, because I can't remember who his wife was off the top of my head. I didn't write it down now, but it's well documented anyway. Yes. Yeah, David Wilson is a descendant, and I don't know, there are a bunch of descendants scattered around the country. Yes, John is one of them. Let me mention just a few other Covenanters who served. We've mentioned Andrew Todd Kennedy, who was wounded capturing Jackson, Mississippi. That same regiment included also four Crawfords, three McClurkins, and three McMillans. And I have no way to tell whether those were all RPs or whether they are related to the Crawford and McClurkin and McMillan families we know now. I just don't know. Their names are on the roll, the roster of Company F. But it appears from that roster that there would be two or three men with the same last name and from Elkhorn Congregation or from Eden Congregation or from Coultersville. So they were all very close there. Now, I should say, too, the regimental system, which the Army was using at that point, generally raises troops within a confined geographical area, so that the people from one area are serving in the same unit. And both the North and the South did that in general. Now, replacements were a different matter. And of course, if a regiment got chopped up in battle, it made it very hard on the community, the county or the town that they were from. But the Army figured that the advantages in terms of morale and camaraderie and so on outweighed the disadvantages. So that was the regimental system. There are some of those names. There's another one. There was an outfit called the 76th Pennsylvania Volunteer Infantry, known as the Keystone Zouaves. And the Zouaves were a kind of elite unit. They were known for their skill on the drill field, and they were kind of the special forces of the time. But they each regiment of Zouaves could design their own uniform, but it was supposed to look kind of Turkish, you know, because that's where it came from. And so they had these pantaloons and bright colored vests and unusual headgear and so on. Well, one of those was William R. Dunn, an RP from the Brooklyn congregation. He had his trigger finger shot off at the Battle of Petersburg, Virginia. It was very tough if you're an infantryman or a sharpshooter to get much done if your trigger finger is missing. So he was considered unfit for combat, so he was transferred to a unit on guard duty at Washington, D.C. So, and by the way, his widow, something like 30, 35 years later, finally got a widow's pension from the government because he was wounded. Four men from the Sharon congregation in Iowa served together in the 39th Iowa Volunteer Infantry. Hugh Walkinshaw was captured at the Battle of Allatoona Pass in northwest Georgia and was sent to Libby Prison. Allatoona Pass, there was a fort there which the Union forces were guarding because it protected a rail line between Georgia and Tennessee. And so they were being attacked, and the Union was outnumbered something like 4 or 5 to 1 in that battle, but they were fighting for all they were worth. Now, according to the legend, they saw a flag signal from Kennesaw Mountain of General Sherman saying, "Hold the fort, I'm coming." And so, according to legend, they held the fort until General Sherman got there and with reserves and was able to save the fort. As a result of this, there was a church musician named Philip P. Bliss who wrote a hymn transferring General Sherman into Jesus. "Hold the fort, for I am coming. Jesus calls loud and clear." And there are two or three stanzas of it, and then the chorus after every verse is, "Hold the fort, for I am coming." So anyway, whether it actually happened that way is dubious, because as you may know, in wartime, very few battles are clear-cut. And what people remember afterwards and what they think they experienced during the battle are usually two different things. And what the official dispatches and orders issued during the battle were doesn't match with what the generals themselves remembered. So this is a nice story anyway. But Allatoona Pass was regarded as a significant battle, even though it was not as big as some of the other ones like Gettysburg. John Lindsay Baird was wounded at Parker's Crossroads in Tennessee. Hugh Henderson died of disease, 1st of February, 1864. Andrew J. M. McConaughey seems to have survived the war and later lived in Nebraska, was in the Beulah congregation there outside of Superior, Nebraska. Now I want to turn to an unsung heroine with an RP background and strongly RP convictions, and that's Jane Grey Cannon Swisshelm. We've referred to her at several points during this study. She was born in Pittsburgh December 6, 1815. Her father was a merchant and real estate speculator. When she was 8, her father and sister died of consumption, which we know as tuberculosis. And then when she was 12, the doctor suspected that Jane was developing it. And so her mother wanted to get them out of the city. Her mother moved her children to a nearby village in the country, Wilkinsburg. Jane made profession of faith and became a communicant member of the Pittsburgh congregation in 1830 at age 15. When the denomination split into Old Light and New Light factions, she followed her beloved pastor, Dr. John Black, into the New Lights. And John Black had been the first RP minister in the Pittsburgh area before 1800. And so when he went with the New Lights, a lot of people went with him because they loved him and they had been blessed by his ministry. In 1836, she married James Swisshelm from a prosperous farm nearby. But he was a Methodist. And although he promised to permit her to continue in RP after marriage, he broke his promises. And he and his mother in particular spent years trying to convert her from being an RP into being a Methodist. They wanted her to become a Methodist minister and just kept up the pressure. But, well, they did not have a happy marriage on the whole. When her husband confiscated all of the estate which she had inherited from her mother, and then confiscated all of Jane's wages that she earned, and it was his right under Pennsylvania law to do those things, she became an ardent advocate for a woman's right to inherit and own property in her own right and to keep the income she earned. From 1838 to 1840, they lived in Kentucky, where she saw the horrors of the slave system. And in about the second class here, I read you an incident that she had experienced in Kentucky when they wanted a servant and a man in a fancy broadcloth suit and gold chains came to offer him an N woman, you know, but you'll have to beat her about twice a week. That wife of yours couldn't handle her. And so Swisshelm said they'd look elsewhere. At the same time, her mother became seriously ill, and Jane wanted to go home to take care of her. Her husband didn't want her to go. What am I going to do? Who's going to wash my socks? But she put her foot down and went home. After her mother died, Jane earned a living writing for various Pittsburgh newspapers. In about 1841, her husband came back from Kentucky, and she lived with him on the farm. And that was not a pleasant experience either. Now, this was in what's now Swissvale in Edgemont, but he had a pet bear for a while, and he had a pet cougar for a while, and he kept the cougar chained up right near the door. Supposedly, it was better than a guard dog, but the cougar scared the bejabbers out of her more than once. She was afraid she was going to become lunch for her husband's pet. Anyway, I should say, too, that that picture is Swissdale, the name that she gave to their family home. This was after they had been in Kentucky and came back. And you can see, even though it's a poor resolution picture, you're seeing it at quite a distance, it's a substantial home. So the Swisshelm family had accumulated quite a bit of this world's goods. Okay, in 1847, after Pittsburgh's only abolitionist newspaper went bankrupt, she established the Pittsburgh Sunday Visitor, and yes, that spelling is right, T-E-R. And somebody had tried to persuade her that, no, Visitor is supposed to be spelled with an O. She said, yes, but not my paper. It was the first newspaper in America to be founded and edited by a woman. Subscription grew rapidly, and in 1850, Horace Greeley hired her as the first regular female correspondent for his paper, the New York Tribune. She became the first female to sit in the press gallery in the U.S. Senate. In 1854, for financial reasons, she sold the Visitor, and in 1857 moved to St. Cloud, Minnesota, and established the St. Cloud Visitor. Now, she had not been able to live with Swisshelm for a number of years, but he refused to grant her a divorce. Finally, in 1861, she read in a newspaper that James had divorced her on grounds of desertion. Well, I guess she deserted the cougar, and that was the end of their marriage. During the war, in 1863, she moved to Washington, D.C., and found work as one of the first female clerks in the Quartermaster General's office. You begin to see a pattern here of firsts. She did a lot of things that women had never done or were not permitted to do or were not expected to do. She kept doing them, kept coming up with new things to try. She also volunteered as a nurse for the United States Sanitary Commission, which oversaw medical care for the armed forces and for veterans. On the left is a row of Army ambulances at Washington, D.C., and you can see that they're basically farm wagons with a frame of canvas over top of them. And, of course, no springs, and so seriously wounded men were laid in those and jostled all the way to Washington or wherever the nearest Army hospital was. On the right is a picture of three of the Sanitary Commission nurses with rather fanciful headgear. It's the only picture I've ever found of those nurses. But that was where she was working part of the time in the war. And she describes in her autobiography very vividly many of the terrible experiences that she had there in the hospitals in Washington. After the war, she stayed in Washington and founded another newspaper called The Reconstructionist. Her press was destroyed and her home burned by an arsonist because she had been critical of President Andrew Johnson and his policies. In 1868, she successfully sued James Swisshelm and won part of his real estate, including the family home, Swissdale. She spent the remainder of her life writing and speaking on women's rights until her death in 1884. 3 years later, in 1887, the legislature of Pennsylvania finally gave married women the same rights as single women, including the right to retain their own property, whether inherited or earned. I should mention, too, as a kind of a sidelight, she's also the reason for the red lights on the back of trains. I don't know whether you've ever noticed, but on the back of trains, there is a red light. When she was in Pittsburgh, there was a serious railroad accident. One train ran into another. I don't know if it was in the dark or the fog or both, but at any rate, there was loss of life with that. And she said, why do we let them, you know, just drive trains in the dark when they don't know what's ahead? If we would just put a little red light on the back of the last car of a train, then some other train coming would know that there was something there. And sure enough, that's why red lights were adopted on the end of trains. Today, a blue historical marker, state marker, honors her at the site of her home, which is near the corner of Braddock and Greendale Avenues in Edgemont. Now, I just quoted this, this is what the website said, just north of exit 9 on I-376. And I question that. In the first place, north, what does north mean? Now it's exit 77. I noticed it this morning as I came in. But you have to be going down Braddock in order to see the beginning of Greendale Avenue, where that marker is. And I don't know, that is there an Applebee's at that corner, or not far from there anyway?
Yeah.
Okay, the borough of Swissvale is named after her husband's family, as is the neighborhood of Swisshelm Park, which is in the southeast corner of the city of Pittsburgh, bordering Regent Square and Swissvale, and across the river from Homestead and Munhall. So the Swisshelm family left lots of evidence of their experience and their wealth in this area. Now, Reformed Presbyterians realized early in the conflict that the freed slaves had severe needs and were basically unable to help themselves. In fact, they were the first Presbyterian denomination to begin humanitarian aid to the freedmen. As early as March 1862, the church sent a minister to see how best to help the freedmen at Port Royal, South Carolina. That's 1862. Then there was an effort to send somebody to Fernandina and St. Augustine, Florida, about the same year. Then shortly thereafter, Little Rock and Devil's Bluff, Arkansas. Then there was an attempt made in Fairfax County, Virginia, and they had about 300 freedmen that they were ministering to there when the Confederates thoughtlessly recaptured the area, and so the RPs had to leave. As soon as the Mississippi River was opened up with the fall of Vicksburg, the church sent missionaries into Natchez, Mississippi, and they worked there until October of 1866. And at that point, the Confederate families came back and they wanted their homes and churches back. And so the RPs had to move out. There was an effort in the District of Columbia where the Synod bought acreage within the city and built a school and a church and 16 tenement houses, each with two bedrooms in it. But there was a terrible problem for the freedmen in Washington because of the rents they were being charged, exorbitant rents they were being charged for inadequate living quarters. So here were new, they were small, but they were nevertheless their own tenements there. And that was to help meet that need for housing. Now, all of these efforts were brief in terms of, you know, no permanent mission or church was established there. At last, in 1874, Selma, Alabama was selected as the location for a permanent mission in the South. In that year, Knox Academy opened its doors. At that point, there was no public school in Selma for blacks, so this was the only opportunity for education in the city. Through financial vicissitudes, Knox Academy existed until 1937, when the city of Selma began to provide education for blacks. Of course, those schools were only for blacks, and the others were only for whites, but at least it was a school. The faculty of Knox Academy were primarily black, but they were supplemented by Geneva College alumni who went out there down there for terms of 2 to 5 years. One of these was the mother of Jim Wright, Greta Johnston, who was the principal of the academy for several years. A congregation was established there, flourished for a number of years, and is still in existence. One of the members of the congregation, W.J. Anderson, established Burwell Hospital as a private hospital because during this period, blacks were not allowed to use white medical facilities. Burwell Hospital, too, continued to serve for many years. Let me summarize. What place should be given to a marginalized group of uncompromising dissenters in the history of a nation in which people have traditionally been taught to get along together by compromise? Though few in numbers, the Reformed Presbyterians exercised remarkable leadership in the anti-slavery movement. Though not the first to condemn slavery, they were apparently the first denomination to make and enforce consistently an absolute prohibition against slave ownership by members. They were among the first to reject colonization schemes and to demand immediate emancipation. Their leading ministers were among the founders and leaders of anti-slavery societies. They were brothers in arms of William Lloyd Garrison and other abolition leaders and speakers. They preached and published often against slavery, sometimes, as somebody pointed out to me at lunch, in rather intemperate language. But they were letting it all hang out. The Reformed Presbyterian Theological Seminary had a racially integrated student body as early as the mid-1840s, and that was unheard of at the time. The church's members and institutions, both the seminary and the college, were active in the Underground Railroad. The church was the first Presbyterian group to establish a mission among the freedmen of the South in the second year of the war. In short, the Reformed Presbyterian Church wielded an influence well beyond what might be expected from so small a number. Moreover, because they did not participate in voting or political parties, they were non-political. And until the outbreak of the Civil War, they prosecuted their campaign only through moral suasion and civil disobedience, such as the Underground Railroad, not through violence or politics. At a time when the majority of people in the United States believed neither that all men are created equal, nor in liberty and justice for all, the Covenanters were a voice of conscience. Their attitude of uncompromising protest against oppression of any kind was a great service to the nation and to its black and white citizens. And with that, I thank you very much for your kind attention, the invitation to come down here.
Thank you.
And that was the second similar incident. There had been before him a black student from Selma named Lawrence Bottoms, who came, and Dr. McKnight told him he would sleep in the basement in the furnace room. And many of you know Howard Elliott. How many remember or know Howard Elliott? He was the one that started downstairs with his bedding and stuff. And McKnight said, "Where are you going?" And he said, "To the cellar, to the furnace room." "Why?" He said, "If he has to sleep down there, I'm sleeping down there." And that was the point at which McKnight backed down and said, "All right, he can come upstairs." So, you know, RPs do not have a perfect record on racism by any means, but how can I put it? And maybe this sounds a little too defensive. Our heart was in the right place on the whole. Yes, the RPs considered it to be a just war because primarily, from the Covenanter perspective, it was primarily a war to end the system of slavery, to free the blacks. And secondarily, of course, it was a war because the Confederate states were rebelling against the constitutional authority. But there were other Northerners, many Northerners, that would not have fought to free the blacks, but were willing to fight to protect the Union. And so there's, and what were President Lincoln's war aims in that war? He never spelled it out, you know, but we have to deduce from what he did what he intended. And so, yes, by applying the principles of just war, that, and I'm not sure I can name all four of them offhand because I wasn't counting on this, but proportionality of force is one of them, a cause to preserve life or independence. Peter, what's the... What?
That it be a winnable war.
Yes, that it be a winnable war. Yeah, that's right. Thank you. It'd be prosecuted justly. So there are the four classic criteria for a just war in Christian thinking. And as far as the Covenanters were concerned, that war met all four of those criteria. Lynn? So he was not serving in 1876 under General Custer. Well, yes. Now, there's a lot of information online, and you can usually locate a man's name, particularly if you know what unit he was in or what state he was from. It's a little tricky sometimes if you don't know that, but you have to get a file number because the War Department had records on something like 6 million men, not all from the Civil War, but from the Revolution, the Civil War, and the Spanish-American War, and the Mexican War. Those 19th century, 18th and 19th century wars. And so looking for one particular man among 6 million, and especially when you consider how many similar names there were, on William Dunn, for instance, there were something like 100 William Dunns in the Union Army at various points in the war. And so you have to know very specifically what was his middle name, where was he from, what family legends are there about him. And one of Louise's cousin's sons, when he was working in Washington several years ago, went to the War Department and dug out the pension records for him and William Dunn, and was able to get copies of them. And so that's well documented, what happened to him and when and where he served and so on. Yeah, it should be. It's going to have to be somebody who can devote their attention just to that issue. But Claude Brown was widely respected in the white community as well as the black in Selma, and had a lot to do with the Freedom March there, although he was not on the Pettit Bridge the day of the attacks. Somebody, were you one of the two ministers that went down to visit Claude and encourage him? Was it Jim Carson? Anyway, there were two RP ministers from the north that were sent down to Selma just to visit Claude and encourage him and pray with him and so on. And one of them, and it must have been Jack, I suppose, told the story about going to a huge meeting of the black community there before the march, and said, "You don't know the experience of realizing that you are in a minority of two." And That's a very different experience for any of us. Well, it's 1:30. Our hour is up. Thanks for your contributions and questions and so on.